Technicians of Spaceship Earth, welcome back to Hawk Binge, your guide to the astral plane that is the Hawkwind discography, one album at a time, in the company of your astounding long-term fan, which is me, and your amazing first-time listener, which is Matt in New York. How are you doing, Matt?
I'm doing very well, thanks, Andy. Happy Olympics time. Just to date the podcast?
Yes, it's definitely Olympics themed in absolutely no way whatsoever.
True, but I'll tell you what, I'm in a really good mood. New York has been messing me about. It's had highs the last couple of weeks of like 35 degrees, which just means that as a British person, I go out and melt as soon as anything happens. But this week has been gorgeous. It's only about a solid 21 right now, which is still t-shirt weather, but great. The sun has been shining. I've been riding my bike. I've been going out to like things which are starting to reopen. And I've done a lot of it whilst listening to the latest Hawkwind album. Or when I say the latest, I mean the one that we're talking about, not obviously the latest.
No.
It's been a good soundtrack to enjoy New York opening up to. So yeah, I'm having a great time. This is also a very nice time for us to be recording. Normally it's either very late for at least one of us, but this is actually very civil.
Yes, it is still daylight here and the sun is shining here as well. So yeah, it's kind of unique. And in amongst all of the life that's happened is some very sad news, actually, because Dusty Hill sadly passed away last week. Bass player of ZZ Top for over 50 years. Always tragic, isn't it? There's a whole generation of rock stars from the 60s and 70s, and we're going to be encountering these things a lot. And some resonate with us more personally than others. I'm not a huge ZZ Top fan, but you know, I've got a good few albums and they're a great band. So very sad to hear of that. And because of that, in our Hawk Binge Sessions playlist, which will be published after today, there will be a track from ZZ Top in honor of Dusty Hill. That track will be Jesus Just Left Chicago, which is by a distance my favorite track from Tres Hombres, which is also by a distance my favorite ZZ Top album. So I was playing that a lot this week. What else have you been playing, Matt, in this past few weeks?
Well, Andy, I was inspired to revisit quite a few Ninja Tune albums because that particular label has started to re-release a lot of albums on vinyl, kind of funky vinyl, like colored vinyl or picture discs or that kind of thing. And most of them I haven't been particularly interested in because I already have classic copies. But one that came in through the email was that they were re-pressing Out From Outwear by Amon Tobin. And I thought to myself, I must have that. Surely I have every single Amon Tobin album. And it turned out there was one I was missing, which was this one, which gave me the perfect opportunity to bag a swanky copy of it on clear vinyl on a double LP, but also to revisit an artist who I have a huge amount of respect for through their entire song-making career. I think that he is one of those producers which just defies pigeonholes or really description. For me, he's one of the evolution of that kind of music concrete type of music where you combine samples with session artists, with things you just made up, with something you grabbed off the internet through something you've made on a synthesizer and just squish it all together. But when he does it, he seems to just also just cover the whole thing in grit and then put it into an oven at 3 million degrees and then take out whatever's left and go, that's a track. Everything about his stuff is always so heavy and industrial, but also just kind of textured. And Out From Outwear is a great example of that kind of music at its finest. I think that's definitely Amon on top of his game. The track which I'm going to add to the playlist is a slightly tamer track, just so it doesn't completely bum out the Hawkwind playlist as it is. But the track is called Hey Blondie and is a super great track.
Sweet. That sounds really good. I remember we went to see Amon Tobin. A hell of a show.
We saw iSam, which was the first time that he had experimented with 3D projections. So he was hidden behind a whole bunch of like what looked like giant sugar cubes.
That's
and it looked
right.
like it was going to be a very underwhelming show until suddenly he kind of hid in one of the cubes and then they all turned into different things. And it's like, oh, this is going to be fun. And it sure was.
Live performance. I can't wait. Anything else?
After we talked for now two episodes about the fall of the Samsara Blues Experiment, I started to listening to those guys again, as I think a lot of people did. And one thing that occurred to me is that half the time when I think I want to listen to a track by Samsara Blues Experiment, I find out what I actually want to listen to is a track by the band Yuri Gagarin, who I think occupy a very similar space. Obviously, the two bands are very different in the way that they approach this genre and the way that they've carved out their own particular niches within it. But I do feel like that kind of heady, explorative psych resurgence also flows through this band. Have we seen Yuri Gagarin? I can't remember if they ever made it to a Desert Fest.
We have. They were on the belt. Yeah, I think it was Underworld where we saw them.
Yeah. So I think maybe because we saw Samsara at the Underworld as well that one time, that maybe, I don't know why, but in my brain, I tend to just squish them together to make just one giant band.
Great band.
Yeah, very cool band. So I went back through their discography and was reliving a lot of that stuff and kept coming back to At the Center of All Infinity, which is, I believe, their second album on Commune 2. Which I think was the one that they were playing through when we listened to them live, which is why whenever I hear it, I get transported back to that happy time. Again, maybe because of live music, again, that kind of jonesing for it. Whenever I listen to something which I know I've seen live, I always get this extra kind of little kick in the heart because of it. But the track Cluster of Minds has been on heavy rotation with me as a way of reliving some of those like glory days.
They were on my shortlist because I have a particular favorite Yuri Gagarin t-shirt, and I was looking for something and I saw it. And that meant I played some Yuri Gagarin. And funnily enough, I played the same album that you went back to. So yeah, they're a great band.
Have you got a track that you preferred? Is that of interest?
Funnily enough, same as you. I'm kind of very much with you where Yuri Gagarin's concerned.
I think like Samsara, I think Yuri Gagarin are one of the few bands where if I've played a track at a friend's house or had it on in the car or something, someone has gone, who's that? And you always feel good about that, you know, when someone asks you. And I think I've had my most success of recommending bands that no one's heard or people asking me who I've been listening to, either Samsara or Yuri Gagarin.
And I have discovered another one completely by chance who are in the same mold, who we've never seen and never heard of. But it's not my choice for this week, so I'm going to keep everyone in suspense until the next episode about who they are. I'm waiting for some vinyl to arrive. But yeah, it's another Scandinavian psychedelic band experience, and they're very cool. So yep, watch this space for that one.
So what have you been listening to that you can share with us, Andy?
I have quite possibly my most random selections. I think the power of the Hawk Binge podcast is that these two bands would never otherwise be mentioned in the same breath, and that is The Monkees and Iron Maiden.
Although Iron Monkee would be a band we'd definitely listen to.
That's very true. Yep, no, that's true. And they probably exist. So I've got an Android phone, which means I get Google Newsfeed. And it's usually quite predictable. You know, if I read a story about Blade Runner, I know I'm going to get sent lots of stories about Blade Runner. But every now and again, they stick in something that's quite random that catches my eye. And then I go off down the rabbit hole. And I got this story that Mickey Dolenz and Mike Nesmith, who are the remaining living members of the Monkees, were doing a final tour playing Monkee songs. And I read that story. And then obviously there are links in there and it kind of takes you further. And I kept reading these stories because I grew up watching the Monkees. Everything that happened on TV in the 60s was repeated endlessly in the 70s, like, you know, Star Trek and all these kind of things. The Monkees was one of them. So me and my brother grew up watching all of that stuff. So the Monkees is something I kind of remember. They started as a TV show, and there were two musicians and two actors pretending to be a band. But they released an album, I think, in the mid-60s, and they were teen heartthrobs. So it smashed the charts, number one for 13 weeks. So they did it again. And I think the first album was only displaced from the top of the charts by the second album. So it was a bit like that. But they didn't play on anything. They sang it, but they didn't play anything. And the band were like, well, you're defrauding the public. We're not a band. We want to be a band, but we're not one. But we're pretending to be one. So they were then allowed from the third album onwards to like write their own stuff and do their own stuff, which they did. And some of it was pretty successful. But they're a really weird band for having this. They start as a fiction and then they kind of become real kind of story arc. They've got some interesting things happen in there. Mickey Dolenz writes a song called Randy Scouse Git, which is a phrase he heard while he was in London. The song isn't anything to do with that. He just called it that because he liked this phrase. I think it's about a party they were at with the Beatles or something. And they release it as a single in the States, but they can't release it in England because RCA, the record company, go, there's no way you're releasing a song with that title in England. You can only release it if you do it with an alternate title. So they release the track in England called Alternate Title. which I also think is pretty exceptional. So it's kind of, this is the rabbit hole that I went down. But in doing so, I did actually get onto Google Music and just go through a whole load of Monkees songs, like on a compilation. And I was kind of astounded that in amongst all the ones that you know, Daydream Believer and all those kind of things, which I can kind of take them or leave them. I know they're brilliant songs, but I'm not too fussed. There's a whole load of pap. But there are some brilliant, brilliant songs in there. And there are songs in there which are just the sound of the 1960s to me, but I never knew was the Monkees. So you'll see some kind of a documentary and it'll be the swinging 60s, the Summer of Love, San Francisco, you know, all of this London scene or whatever. And there'll be songs playing and you know the songs and it is just the soundtrack of the 60s, but I don't really know who recorded them. But there's a song called I'm Not Your Stepping Stone, and it came on and it started playing and I'm going, what? That's the Monkees. And that song and Last Train to Clarksville, which is a track that I've always loved. It's just an absolute killer of a tune. So I was playing those and a few others on rotation for a good few days. So the Monkees have to be on it. And I'm Not Your Stepping Stone will be the track. I think Last Train to Clarksville I actually prefer, but I was so shocked with I'm Not Your Stepping Stone being the Monkees that has to be the one. So that's the Monkees, and more there on Monkey Binge, our forthcoming Monkees podcast. and the second one is that Iron Maiden unveiled the lead track off a new album that they're releasing last week. The new album's going to be called Senjutsu, and they released this track called Writing on the Wall. I'm not a diehard Maiden fan, although I do have 7 or 8 Maiden albums, and they're probably all the ones you'd expect, plus 1 or 2 modern ones. And I've seen them 3 times, I think, in the 80s and 90s. I saw them headline Donington. So I've got some history with Maiden, do like them, love a lot of stuff, but I'm not like a dyed-in-the-wall, love-every-track fan. The new track, I was a little bit meh on it, to be honest. I preferred the lead track off the previous album, Speed of Light off Book of Souls, but it did make me listen to a few of my old Maiden albums. And in particular, I ended up pretty solidly playing Power Slave and Somewhere in Time back to back, because they are definitely my favorite albums. So Somewhere in Time is the one that I'm going with, and Strange in a Strange Land, which is by a distance my favorite Maiden track of all time, will be on the Hawk Binge Sessions playlist. And there are enough tracks now that we've selected that will go up, and we'll give all the information about where you can find that at the end of the pod. So before we dive into 1976, it is time to have a look and see what people have said to us since our Warrior on the Edge of Time episode. We invite people to correct us where we're hideously wrong, and this time they have. We're kind of starting off here with a bit of a Warrior on the Edge of Time addendum. And the first point of order in here was that we'd said that Barney Bubbles was nowhere to be seen doing the cover art for Warrior on the Edge of Time. And it was actually two people, Comte Pierre d'Auvergne and Eddie Brash, who did the cover art. Well, it turns out that Eddie Brash actually is Barney Bubbles. It's a pseudonym, Barney Bubbles. He only did the inside cover, though. So all of that big artwork, unfolding stuff, shield on one side, et cetera, is the other guy. Barney Bubbles did the inside cover. As corrected on that by both friend of the pod, Joe Banks, and Corinth Ian, otherwise known as Ian. So thanks very much for that. That was good to know, because there were a couple of people who actually emailed and said, yeah, it's a shame Barney wasn't on there. So it's good to know that we're not the only two people in Hawkwind Land who were unaware of that. So that's a good one, and thanks very much for that. And then Bramwell Johnson emailed. We'd been talking about Kings of Speed on that album, which is, you know, not one of my favorites. And we'd come to the conclusion that it does feel bolted on, because it does feel bolted on because it was bolted on. But actually, it was first written for an album for Michael Moorcock's band, Deep Fix, called New World's Fair. So it's even more bolted on because it was actually written for somebody else entirely. Although I'm sure that Michael Moorcock's Deep Fix probably had a fair bit in common with various Hawkwind lineups. So thanks for those. There was something that came your way as well, wasn't there, Matt?
Yes, I got a couple of comments on the YouTube drops. One of them was from a poster called Cynical Syndicalist. I think I've said that right. And he recommended to check out the Roadhawks compilation at some point because it is a Dave Brock mixed album and has Wind of Change flowing into Golden Void, which means I will be able to enjoy it without the annoying Assault and Battery track that I'm not a huge fan of. So I'm very glad for that recommendation. We'll certainly be checking that out. Thank you very much. Another comment I got was, I think it was just more just like a passing comment more than anything, but it was a joke on whenever I say it's interesting, he takes a drink and is normally dead by the end of the podcast. And I just wanted to address that slightly because it is a habit which I deliberately employ most of the time. It was something that I was given as a tip professionally as a creative in the advertising field. There's a lot of times when pressure is high and time is short, and you can be listening to other people's ideas or reviewing their work, and you either say it's good or it's bad very quickly and then start talking. And by saying it's good or it's bad, what you instantly do is limit the amount of language you're then going to use because you've already set up your opinion, and then all you're going to do is justify it, which then means that if you say, for example, you don't like something without having given it the chance, you will never know if there was anything good in it. So I was always taught to say, where possible, that's interesting, and then use that as your jumping off point, because then you can draw a conclusion, but it just stops you colouring the discourse. And given the fact this is a conversation and not just me giving my kind of out of the blue opinion, I like to explore this band because I am coming to it from a very, very like newbie point of view. And although there are some tracks which I feel like I definitely have an opinion on, a lot of them, I don't get to really have an opinion until I talk to Andy, which is normally the first person I've ever talked to about the album. So I do say it's interesting a lot for that reason. And yeah, I hope the listener is not dead yet listening to all of our podcasts. And I hope that they do continue to listen to them. And if anyone wants to know why I'm saying that, it is for that reason. And it's actually a thought exercise I would recommend anyone takes up if ever they are asked to review something without having to jump to any kind of conclusion.
But two things there. One is that I might start drinking a shot every time you say interesting. And then by the end of the podcast, it could be very, very intriguing to see what kind of condition I'm in. And then secondly, I now know that when I say something and you say interesting, you're not convinced necessarily by what I've said. And the tension will be high as I see which way you go from there on. So yeah, thanks for those. That's cool. And good to get some notes in from those avenues. We've got a few others. So Ian, who was one of the people who pointed out the error on Barney Bubbles, also suggested that I listen to an artist called Harvest Man, a.k.a. Steve Van Til, on a fine collection of Hawkwind covers called Hawkwind Triad. So I sought that out. Hawkwind Triad, you can find it. It's out there. And they're all tracks from this kind of early period Hawkwind, those first albums that we've already covered. And some of them are pretty decent, but they're not by any bands that anyone will ever have heard of. Well, that's not true. Someone would have heard of them. I hadn't heard of them. And in this case, I count for everyone. So yeah, seek it out. That's a cool one. And thanks, Ian, for the shout. Tim Owen, welcome aboard. It says that part of his Hawkwind heritage was that he was freaked out by Sonic Attack. That's four or five albums away from where we are, so you won't be freaked out again for a good few months just yet. Sean McMahon, who re-listens to the albums before listening to the podcast with us, so that's great. We love it when people take the journey with us. And Rob Crow, who pointed out that the Space Ritual version of Down Through the Night includes a riff in the intro that sounds a lot like California Uberalis by the Dead Kennedys, written a good few years later, and talks about how Jello Biafra is a big fan of Hawkwind. So that's going to be interesting, and we'll touch on that. He also sent me a link to his own band called Wahoo Ghost. That's W-A-H-O-O, Ghost. Who have an album and a track they've done a video for called She-Wolf. Pretty cool. And thanks for the link, Rob. And lastly, a very nice shout out for us from the Lap of the Pods guides on the Deep Dive Podcast Network. We really appreciate that. And right back at you. So that is the postbag. And now it's time to get into 1976. So this was really interesting. I dived into 1976 and the album releases of 1976, and I was fully expecting to see the beginnings of change because we know what's coming. We know punk and new wave are coming. And I was expecting to see in 1976, like a presence of a bunch of these bands and a bunch of releases and a crossfade, if you like, from what we've been into that. So I'm looking through all these album releases and nothing of the sort, pretty much absolutely nothing. The list of releases I'm going to go through, there are some amazing albums in there, some real giant albums. But basically, it's more of the same. 1976 is much more part two of 1975 than it is part one of 1977. I skipped ahead and I looked at 1977, and 1977 just goes boom. It makes a bit more sense when I actually looked at all the bands that were formed in 1976. And the roll call of bands formed in 1976 includes The Adverts, The Damned, The Clash, Bad Manners, Black Flag, The Buzzcocks, The Fall, Joy Division, and Madness. So what you can kind of see is that the roots are there. All of these bands have come together, that they don't release anything until 1977.
Right. So they're like on the starting blocks and they're just waiting now for like their chance to run through.
Exactly. So kind of what you almost get is this kind of conclusion of the early part of the 70s with what we're going to get. You get a smattering of glam rock, Burning Embers Are Still Glowing. You get some funk, you get a fair bit of disco, you get a lot of rock. It's a pretty decent year for the Deep Dive Podcast Network, which I'll introduce again at the end of the pod, but there's a few albums coming from those guys. There is one clue in that the Ramones do release their debut album in 1976, but when you look at everything else, you get Frampton Comes Alive, which is kind of Peter Frampton's emergence into the limelight. Talking about the last vestiges of glam, well, David Bowie's already moved on from that. He releases Station to Station and The Thin White Duke. Run with the Pack is released by Bad Company, Gimme Back My Bullets by Lynyrd Skynyrd. Genesis released two albums, Trick of the Tail at the beginning of the year and Wind and Wuthering at the end of the year, which are the first two albums they do after the departure of Peter Gabriel. So that's the first time that Phil Collins is on the mic. They're both awesome albums as well. Shamal is released by Gong. Nobody's Fool by Slade. Marvin Gaye, I Want You. Paul McCartney's Wings release Wings at the Speed of Sound. Thin Lizzy release Jailbreak. Led Zeppelin, the mighty Led Zeppelin release Presence, which is also a brilliant album. Give Us a Wink by Sweet. The Landmark 2112 is released by Rush. So there's a fair bit of progressive music in there as well. Van de Graaff Generator release both World Record and Still Life this year. Rainbow release Rainbow Rising. Agents of Fortune is released by Blue Oyster Cult. Jeff Beck releases Wired. So you can kind of see these are names we've become fairly familiar with. Rod Stewart, A Night on the Town. Take the Heat Off Me, Boney M. So the disco's starting to come in. Great album title, this one. The Clones of Dr. Funkenstein. Parliament, love that. The Manhattan Transfer, who everybody may have forgotten, but my mum loved the Manhattan Transfer, and they released Coming Out. A new world record, not related to Van de Graaff Generator, that's Electric Light Orchestra. Dirty Deeds Done Dirt Cheap, AC/DC. Children of the World by the Bee Gees. Spirit by Earth, Wind and Fire. ABBA release Arrival, which is the one with Dancing Queen on it and Knowing Me, Knowing You. So that was absolutely enormous, and I have that on vinyl, believe it or not. From the time, I think I was given it for Christmas or something and still have it. Frank Zappa releases Zoot Allures. Sparks release Big Beat. The Jacksons come out with a record. Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers come out with a record. Foghat, everybody's favourite word. Whenever they release an album, I will say it, release Night Shift. Oxygen, which I mentioned last time out, that was a pick on Sessions playlist. That's out this year. Queen release Day at the Races, which is an excellent album. And Uriah Heep, also from the Deep Dive Podcast Network, release Firefly. So you can see there aren't many clues in there as to what is about to happen. But, you know, in pubs and clubs across the land, all of those people are coming together to put those bands together who are going to kind of blow the world up the following year. So into the studio in 1976 goes this lineup of Hawkwind. Dave Brock, Nick Turner, Robert Calvert is back, and more on him in a minute. Paul Rudolph, who last time we talked about, he came in to replace the mighty Lemmy on bass, but he also plays a lot of very kind of clean guitar lines on this album. Simon House is still there, and the drum duet of Simon King and Simon Powell. They record this album. It's released 76. It makes number 33 on the UK chart, so it's the lowest of their last kind of run of albums. It's outside the top 30. 33 seems to me to be still pretty respectable, but I imagine that it caused a few ructions within the band, not being top 20, top 15, whatever, as they have been. And this is a very, very interesting and tumultuous time for Hawkwind. His new label is Charisma. There's something of a transition going on here, and almost a, not a battle maybe, but there is something going on with the identity of the band. It can go in several different directions at this point. You kind of have this Brock Calvert vision for it on one hand, and then you've got Paul Rudolph and Alan Powell writing songs which are very different on the other hand. And it's an interesting clash of those different ideas, this album. But it's going to end up going one way or the other. It's a fascinating time in the Hawkwind story. It's covered exceptionally well by both of the books that I've been reading a lot of. Kind of keep reading the books as we get to the sections rather than kind of reading them just cover to cover. Sonic Assassins by Ian Abrahams and Days of the Underground by Joe Banks. They go into a lot of detail, so it's definitely worth reading those books. We're not going to cover a huge amount of it here. But there are a couple of things which are kind of worth getting into. So with this two camps, it's quite well illustrated by a quote from Alan Powell about the track City of Lagoons, where he says, "It's actually a demo I made in my flat. The only people on it are Rudolph, House, and myself. It's not really Hawkwind. I wanted it to sound like Pink Floyd." So that's a quote from Ian Abrahams' book, Sonic Assassins, but it quite outlines the situation nicely because you've got a track here that Dave Brock isn't even on. So you can see that there are very different directions being taken by the band. So you've got this clash of styles going on, which is really interesting. It's resulted in Dave not liking the record at all. And then I think when Dave doesn't like the album then gets something of a bad press. As Ian Abrahams says in his book, and I quote, "It's a record that has been unfavorably demeaned over the years, in almost equal proportion to the way its immediate predecessor, Warrior on the Edge of Time, had been mythologized as a pinnacle of classic Hawkwind. Maybe that's a direct result of Dave Brock's famous recollection that on hearing the copy of the LP for the first time, he'd thrown it out of the window like a frisbee." These sorts of quotes linger around until they become accepted wisdom or collective fandom. It's absolutely wrong. Sorry, Dave. So Ian's obviously a big fan of this album. A lot of people are. But it does have this very split rep. You have got these two kind of two camps in the band. Read the books if you want to really go much, much further on this. There's a lot in here. But it's, I think it's interesting just as context for listening to the album that these clashes of styles are going on. In addition, I would just point out that in reading these books for this part of the show, there's an amazing chapter in Friend of the Pod Joe Banks' book, Days of the Underground, called Existing in a Genre of One, where he compares Hawkwind at this time to basically being in their own genre in the same kind of way that, say, Roxy Music or Brian Eno, David Bowie and Black Sabbath were. So it kind of has comparisons between them. Black Sabbath, it's quite a countercultural equivalence that he draws. But some really interesting stuff in there. This period of the band is really interesting, you know, useful to get into. So that is 1976. But before we get Matt's hot take on the album, we need to look at Robert Calvert because he is back and he has basically become a kind of co-leader of the band. He's going to be a big, big figure in the band moving forwards. We have come across him before. You know, he's done some spoken word stuff, but he's back in a much bigger context this time. So to give Matt a little bit of homework and a little bit of context for who Robert Calvert is, I did ask him to give a quick listen to Calvert's album, Captain Lockheed and the Starfighters, which also has on it Paul Rudolph and a bunch of others. It's there's a lot of Hawkwind on that album. We're not going to do like a deep dive into it, an analysis of it. Matt hasn't taken a whole bunch of notes. We've promised we will come back to it in about 5 years' time when we finish all the studio albums. But for now, it was just to introduce, really, Robert Calvert as the frontman of the band to Matt. So this is Matt's immediate ultra-hot take of Captain Lockheed and the Starfighters.
If I was in a band or controlling a band and someone said, we want to bring this person in and this is the last thing they did, I might have thrown myself out of a window. It's an experimental album, I guess, in terms of the content it's making, but it was hard going for me. The flow of this album is a bit like Warrior on the Edge of Time in that there's music which is constantly interrupted by people talking nonsense, which for me, it just doesn't make an enjoyable album. And having it done twice in so many weeks for me has not sweetened the concept. I called it like Hawkwind does Monty Python with the way that they were doing their talking and their kind of impressions of the Germans, which was, I guess, made more sense in the 70s. Now it just feels a little bit dated.
Yeah.
But also it just felt like they just put the first take on the record. There are some of those where I'm like, if you're going to do them, at least do them well. There's at least a few where people seem to just wander off and wander back in again in terms of the volume and the impressions and everything. It was interesting that I heard a couple of things, including the phrase assault and battery was used several times just in the spoken word, which then comes across in the other album. So I guess maybe there were some mixes of ideas happening. But I think like the music was fine. It was a little quote unquote basic, you know, a little kind of basic rock for me. I think the Right Stuff track was probably a highlight of the whole thing. But yeah, I think I'd rather listen to Hawkwind.
Well, that's fair. I think I'd rather listen to Hawkwind. I do love the album, though. I must admit, I got it many, many years ago, and I picked up a double vinyl version of it fairly recently. Gee, for Germany, it does still make me smile. The interesting thing to take from it is that he's obviously a very theatrical person.
Mm-hmm. I think some of the 70s radio drama I just have never got into, or anything too Kenneth Williams-y or something like that. The idea of just putting a slight funny voice on seemed to just make 1970s radio audiences just roll in the aisles. That's never really done it for me. So I think that probably doesn't help, you know, like.
I promise not to do it again. No, I hear what you're saying. I hear what you're saying. I think it's also famously, of course, he also did write Silver Machine.
Yeah.
So that's what he's been doing. He's been hanging out with the band like on and off for a good few years. He's obviously friends with them, but he's done his own thing. Now he is in the band properly as a fully paid up member. And Astounding Sounds, Amazing Music is what they release. So it is time to get Matt's hot take on Astounding Sounds and Amazing Music.
I think I say this every time, but every time a new Hawkwind album arrives for me to listen to, I always wonder where they're going to go. You know, I've never been able to predict quite what they're going to show up with. And I, once again, was not expecting Amazing Sounds to sound anything like it sounded. The first time I listened to it, I was completely floored once again from the first track all the way through. I was thinking, okay, this is the direction they've gone again. But it did not take many listens for me to really get into this album. Surprisingly, I think it feels like my kind of Hawkwind. After the heaviness, the artistry, the intensity, the concept rich laden thing that was the previous album, this album feels like it's not taking itself so seriously. It's not over encumbered by too much thought. It's just the right amount of playfulness for Hawkwind. It's a fun, unironically enjoyable album. I find it's very easy to get swept up in the energy of it and the kind of the, not the earnestness, but the kind of, it feels like they're doing it with a lot of heart, you know, and you can't help but get swept up in that, whether or not you can like it or not. It's very nicely produced. It's obviously been done with, I feel like, an increasing amount of skill and craft in terms of how they put the songs together. I don't think this album could have existed had Lemmy stayed in the band. I feel like a lot of the bass lines are now bass lines and less low-end guitar in terms of the way that they're put together. I feel that they're more complementary, they're a bit more soft, they're not normally like the riffy kind of bass lines that we've had previously. For example, the breakdown of Steppenwolf, I don't think would have worked had Lemmy been involved in that breakdown, because then at that point, the bass line just becomes this kind of soft pluck, which ties the breakdown and then the jam together, where if the bass was more involved, I think it would have suddenly become a bit more like raucous and a bit more rocky and maybe a bit more like how they were. So I do feel this has a softer edge all the way through it. I feel like it's somehow a little bit camp in places. It's a little bit, like you said, maybe a little bit like theatrical in its nature. What it is lacking for me is the Hawkwind dystopianness. There's a little bit of it, but I feel like a lot of this is about seeing the truth, getting high, whether or not that's chemically, spiritually, or actually from various states of physical elevation that they go through in this. I think that the inclusion of some new ideas are welcome. There's one track which really doesn't do it for me, but I think it's 90% good music on this for me. So it wasn't what I was expecting. On the whole, I really enjoyed listening to it. Weirdly, it feels short compared to the last two albums, or maybe it's just because of the way things have been interrupted and I was kind of forced to listen to it in a way. This, because it's just tracks, I listen to the first two tracks and then I feel like I blink with my mind and then the album's over. It feels very strange that how quickly it is to listen to it. I feel like as soon as I listen to it, I listen to it again just because I can't believe I finished it. So I think that might be something to do just with the arrangement or the fact you do have two very long tracks at the beginning and then it kind of gets into more kind of morsely pieces. But yeah, because of the ease of the listen, it feels like it's a very quick listen. But no, I think my overall notes are, it's just fun, this album.
It's going to be fascinating, this one, because this is definitely an about turn. I've had one or two emails in the past saying, Andy, you should defend the music more when Matt's not so keen, basically, which I tend not to do because that's not what this podcast is about. In this case, cards on the table, this actually isn't one of my favorite Hawkwind albums. There's nothing on it that I hate, but it kind of just sails past me without having an awful lot of effect. I find the subject matter for the songs isn't as escapist, mystical, science fiction, whatever, which is what my brain kind of associates with Hawkwind and wants to go there. So it's always been one that I've listened to a couple of times, but it's never been something that I've played solidly for a week or two before until we were preparing for this podcast, in which case, obviously, it's exactly what I did. And yeah, it hasn't really changed. It's a fascinating album because I don't listen to it that much, which means that when I do listen to it, I always pick up things that I hadn't picked up before because I've not really given it that deep listen. But this will be an intriguing turnaround because this is the first album we've done that you actually like more than I do.
Maybe. Do you actually own this one? Because this is the only one you haven't taken a picture of and sent me. So I wasn't sure if you just passed this when you were... Okay.
No, I do. I will. And
so
I will.
That was just an oversight. Okay.
Yes, I will take those pictures and they will go up on our feeds when we release this podcast.
Sure. I was just wondering whether or not there was a legacy of you not liking this, you know, like when you were younger listening, or whether or not this was something that we just forgot about.
I mean, back in the day, you didn't tend to hear the albums before you bought them. And now, of course, you know, you listen to them online and then it's a question of wanting them on vinyl. But back when I got this, which would have been at a Brighton record fair, probably, I would have picked it up purely because it said Hawkwind on it.
But as we have established, the window option is there. So I wasn't sure if you liked it enough to physically eject it or whether or not you wanted to resell it or something. But it is still part of your collection.
Yeah, yeah. I like it a lot more than Dave does. I think that's fair to say, although the bar is low. And with that, let's get into this track by track.
So we start the album with a kind of probably the most sinister track that, you know, the most dystopian we're going to get to in this album. But even then, I feel like the whole thing is done in some kind of ironic or parody style. So even this track is not the kind of we're all doomed, cyborgs are taking over the world kind of thing that we've had before. This feels like a tribute to a B-movie or some kind of government mandate about the evils of marijuana. Whatever, it's fine. We start with the train, which then goes into a little bit of a riff. It's a nice little riff, but it's not there for long before they just like crash straight into the track. You know, it's like Hawkwind have got something to say and we're going to get there very quickly. I actually quite like it because there's a strange mix of delivery and the singing. There seems to be someone more tunefully singing in the background, but sounds like they're kind of at the back of the room shouting at a distant microphone, while someone very close to the microphone is kind of half singing, half talking in a spooky narration way. So I kind of like the mix of those things. It has an interesting delivery. Yeah, talking about the evils of reefer madness, which seems to be some kind of demonic entity which is going to come and get your kids as they're having too much fun with the wacky tobacco. This track cements for me my feeling that the piano is not Hawkwind's strongest instrument. I feel like whenever they bring a piano into it, it goes a bit vaudeville somehow and just feels like some kind of amateur dramatics production. I feel like the piano is not helping that vibe that they're already establishing in this track, which then goes into the fact, well, if they're going to go that way, then I guess I have to just listen to it like that. And then I kind of, you know, enjoy it more knowing that it will never get up to the heady heights of art, which some of these tracks have got to, which again, that's for me where this whole album is. You know, it's very self-satisfied, so you can't help but love it. You know, it's kind of like a two-year-old coming downstairs wearing his dad's shirt and going, I'm off to work or something. You know, you just get this kind of feeling of like, it's so adorable that it thinks it's an album that you just have to kind of like it. And I think that's kind of why I do. It is groovy. It's fun. It's got like a good vibe to it. The story's weird. The first time I heard it, I thought, what the hell is going on? Has Hawkwind been made by the Canadian government to do some kind of PSA because they got caught with drugs again? But then you realize that they're obviously doing it in a silly way, as silly Hawkwind sometimes does. For me, the track really gets interesting around the kind of 4 minute mark where they break the track down and it comes down and you have this really nice acidy, moogy bass line on a synth, which I really like. The saxophone is really nice in this, the kind of like sort of bleepy madness which comes over it. There's another synth solo like over the top. That for me is when it gets really, really nice and groovy. I really enjoy that. So the actual, like, you know, story element, I can kind of take or leave. A bit like in a way how the Assault and Battery Golden Void thing happens. Like when that part of a track rolls off and this new bit kind of comes in, that's when it starts to really kick into me and I really start to enjoy it. The little story of the guy who was smoking and suddenly looked at his fingers and then saw that there were 11 of them. Like, that for me is the kind of delivery from Hawkwind that I enjoy. And I'm assuming that's Calvert.
Yeah, that's Calvert.
Right. So as an introduction to him on this album, I like that. It's, again, it's fun. It's weird. It's a very small idea, the idea of having an extra finger that then falls off and steals your weed. But it's delivered in such a way that you just think it's somehow really imaginative and really easy to understand. You know, like sometimes they're singing about stuff which I have no idea what's going on. Magnu the horse and the idea of like running over the cosmos as the world is built beyond you and being a warrior on the edge of time. Sometimes it's a lot. But I can imagine having an extra finger that falls off and goes off and nicks your stuff. So, you know, that I kind of like. And again, I think it, again, is indicative of the intelligence level of the album. It's kind of, you know, it's not trying to be profound. It's trying to be very easy to get. I like that little delivery. I think it's fun. And then they kind of bring in a whole load of recorded chatter. It just sounds like the band is just shouting at each other like while they're playing, or maybe it's dubbed over, I'm not sure. But that bit really reminded me of Hey Bulldog by the Beatles, you know, at the end when everyone's just like shouting at each other over the piano riff.
That's a good shout, yeah.
So yeah, I thought that was kind of fun. It just feels very organic and very like you're in the room with them. I can imagine like this being something that they literally never did before they recorded it. And that would make perfect sense to me. So yeah, it's a track which, again, after the previous album, I wasn't ready for, but it's one of the first Hawkwind opening tracks, which I can say I'm perfectly fine with. So that's a plus for the listeners, hopefully.
Yeah, that's a pretty good start. I've got to say, this is one of my top Hawkwind tracks, period, Reefer Madness. So it's funny, given that the album as a whole, I'm a little bit less, you know, massively enthusiastic on. It's funny that it starts out with something I think is an absolute banger. I love Reefer Madness. The tour that you came to see, that we saw, the Warrior on the Edge of Time tour, that lineup of the band would play this and Steppenwolf live. And I really get into it. It is actually Calvert writing a parody of, I think, a 1936 film, as you say, which was to demonstrate the dangers of these things. It was one of those things that kind of like teenage kids in black and white taking a puff and then instantly going insane and stabbing people. And it was all that kind of thing. So it's Calvert's parody take on that. The chorus of this, I think, is just really kicks. So yeah, I'm a huge, huge fan of this track. Steppenwolf.
This track has been an event during the time I've been listening. The first time I heard it, I was like, oh, Hawkwind found a Santana record somewhere and just went, yeah, we'll do that for a bit. It's strange because it sounds so that kind of vibe, which again is something I haven't really heard them do before, but they do it really well. I feel like this has a real infectious groove considering the subject matter. I feel like it's delivered in a really strong, groovy way. And I'm assuming this is Calvert again. Yeah, this is.
Yeah. So it's written by Calvert and Brock, but all of the words, everything's going to be Calvert.
So this for me is when Calvert really shines. I think the delivery again is borderline ridiculous, but also makes me love the track in the same way that I feel like when Calvert does it right, he can really get involved in a way which is actually very, very becoming. I think that the rhyming on the tracks is amazing. There's this lovely kind of lilting staccato to it. There's some really lovely like imagery of this, the idea of walking past a pool of liquid sky sounds amazing. I can imagine that idea of just being like, it's basically like a puddle, I'm assuming, because when you look into a puddle in a particular type of light, you can see the sky reflected in it. But even just calling it that sounds really nice. The rhymes are good. The idea of electrically static fur that can sense things from miles around, all that kind of stuff. It feels, again, very visceral, which I feel like that 11 Fingers thing has. It has this kind of feeling of viscerality, which I can really just understand and empathize with and relate to. The story's fun, obviously very weird, but it's very easy to get caught up in it. There's a bit which I think is hilarious after the second part of the track, like after the breakdown. There's a whole couple of lines which says, he finds a sign on a wall or a door. The line is, the sign said to the magic theatre, it is not for everyone. It is but for madmen only. The first performance has begun. And that sounds really cool. But I was thinking, who put that sign up? Why do you put a sign up after the performance has started? Why do you not put a sign up saying to the magic theatre, like, hurry up? There's a lot to put on a sign. And it's those kind of things which just always make me feel like, what is this city we're in that people are putting signs up for things already in progress? That took a long time for me to try and unpack, and I still don't think I'm over it. But the whole world is fantastic. And musically, it's just great. Like, Hawkwind are the masters now of the long breakdown. You know, before they used to do breakdowns, and then they did what I used to call like the instrument babble. And it was a bit muddy and a bit hard to really appreciate. I feel like in the last two recordings, they've got these just absolutely down pat. The sax breakdown after the chorus is always really nice. The way it just kind of comes in and helps accentuate the chorus. In the breakdown, when the violin comes in, that always gets me. Whenever I hear it, I just think it's absolutely gorgeous. It's really evocative. It just cuts through, just has this wistfulness to it, which Hawkwind is so good at creating. It's so atmospheric. A little bit like the previous track, I like this from the breakdown on, like the second part of the track. I really like, again, it's got some of these really nice staccato things where he says like a freak, a fiend, a figment of mind, has that like, it's all ding, 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 ding. You know, I think it's just enunciated so nicely, which just really helps with the whole track. But yeah, the breakdown into the second part of the whole track, I think is really good. This might be one of my favorite tracks that Hawkwind have done, weirdly. It's whenever it has come on in my listens, I've always paid a lot of attention to it. And surprising Santana groove, strange story, Calvert on top of his game, violin during the breakdown. Yeah, all of that just together is just a great little package.
That's a pretty good description. My own feedback on this, really. I like this track. I wish it were a little bit shorter. It goes on for quite a long time for me. It's one that I'm really enjoying. And then I'm slightly weary of it. And I remember when I saw it played live, and I hadn't played the track for quite a long time, saw it played live, was really into it. But then the breakdown went on, the whole I am a man wolf, I am a wolf man, all of that bit. And it went on for quite a long time. And I thought, oh, they've really dragged this out live. And then I went and listened to it, and it was like, oh no, they haven't. This is how long it is. That's really my only criticism. And usually when I like something, it's like, no, this can go on for as long as it needs to. But yeah, this could have done with being edited down by a few minutes, I think, for me. But it's a strong track for sure.
I agree that I think that's why I say from the breakdown on, I really like it. I don't mind it being as long as it is, but I think you're right. It does start to maybe outstay its welcome a touch. Not to the point where I take too many points off.
No, fair play, fair comment. Which leads us to the final track on side one of the album, which is the aforementioned City of Lagoons, written by Powell and recorded by Powell, House and Rudolph.
Yeah, so this is not a window ejection scenario for me. I actually really like this track. The funky groove vibes are still there. It's not Hawkwindy in its dystopianness. Again, it is in their very relaxed and groovy frame of mind. I don't think we've heard one of these tracks this far up in the track list order, which was interesting to me. Normally they reserve these tracks for the C or D side of the album. So the fact this is on the A side, I thought was interesting, and then started to make me feel like maybe that is because the vibe of this album is a lot more relaxed and groovy than a lot of the other stuff that we've heard. It has a lot of really nice catchy loops to it that gives me house music brain itch, which is cool. Weirdly, the way it's processed and the lazy tempo or the dreamy effects over it, it almost feels like how vaporwave feels now. You know, like the way producers either make or take older tracks, absolutely drench them in reverb and delay, and then like take some of the mids and the bass out so it sounds like a radio in another room. It's got that kind of vibe to it. But they're doing it in the 70s, so it's kind of proto-vaporwave vibe, which I thought was really interesting that it's kind of come back around again. One thing I like about this is it feels like an improvisation done really nicely. The little two-note key riff that kind of happens at the end of every four bars just snaps you back. It's like a mental reset, like, okay, we're back here again, we're back here again, we're back here again. I likened it to almost like a typewriter. And for me, it just allows me to really get into what the other elements are doing, because they're wandering around, they're improvising, but occasionally you get these two notes and just wham, I'm right back into the start of the bar and then off we go again. So I find it very satisfying. I feel like the track kind of has this very innate control to it, but it's not overpowering you with it. It's just doing enough to hold your interest and do its thing. And it even has a satisfying fade at the end, which, again, I feel like Hawkwind are still not very good at ending tracks, but this one even just peters out in a nice way, I guess because it's the end of the record, so they weren't going to do anything weird. This was the first track when I was listening to the album for the first time that made me relax into Hawkwind again, because the first two tracks are big stories done in a more theatric way. This is just like pure instrumentation, pure experimenting, people messing around, obviously having fun, creating a spacey experience, more spacey than the other two tracks for sure. So this allowed me to settle back down into an almost like classic Hawkwind feeling for me. So yeah, the whole thing for me is just massively satisfying. And I'm kind of sad that other people, even in the band, weren't into it.
I definitely see this through the lens of three people who made this track. And the person who you think of as the dominant person in Hawkwind, Dave Brock, is not one of those people. So you wonder how much of his opinion of the track is colored by the fact that he's not on it. And at this point, there is a which way is this band going to go kind of story going on. I don't dislike the track. I quite like the track, but it doesn't really feel Hawkwind-y to me because, as Alan Pattle said, he was trying to make it sound like Pink Floyd. He really succeeded. And I didn't realize he was desperately trying to make it sound like Pink Floyd. I've always thought it just sounded like Pink Floyd. There's something in the synthesizer tones and notes, basically in sounds, which are very Rick Wright. And then those clean guitar notes that Paul Rudolph is playing. It's not David Gilmour. It's Gilmour-esque. It's more of a Gilmour sound than Dave ever played. I thought it was quite nice. It didn't move me particularly, but I just thought it was quite nice. Nothing offensive about it. But it didn't have those kind of trademark Hawkwind sounds. And hearing that quote from Alan Powell, oh, that's why it doesn't have any of those trademark Hawkwind sounds, because that's not what he was trying to do. Its sound quality is, you know, is right up there, the clarity of it, the production of it. And he actually says, in the kind of research, what little of it that I do for these things, I really like Alan Powell, just as a guy. There's a lot of quotes by him, and he just sounds like he's a really chilled guy. We'll get to this in the aftermath, but basically at the end of the day, they sack him and he kind of goes, yeah, if I'd been them, I'd have sacked me as well. And basically, I respect
that. Very British.
Exactly. Reaction. But he says, this is a quote from Days of the Underground by Joe Banks. He says, Paul Rudolph and I had a lot of studio experience. I had a lot of studio experience. For me, Hawkwind in the studio was just appalling. The quality of the sound and production was at best amateurish. If I listen to Warrior now, it sounds like it was recorded on a Sony cassette player. It's just terrible. They'd go to the studio, set up microphones and just start playing. And that's not how you get good quality recording. But Astounding Sounds was recorded to proper standards. So it was a completely different sound. I don't think Dave liked it. He preferred it raw and ragged. And that did cause problems. But you can totally hear, I think, that this is a different level in the clarity of the sound recording. And I do like that. I have to say that I'm kind of with Alan that is a really good sound. It's a really good sound for this record. And it's why I like the Stephen Wilson remaster of Warrior. It's why I'd love to hear him redo a couple of the early ones. I love the early ones. brought up with that rawness of sound, like Black Sabbath, that sound like they're recorded in a swamp, but that becomes part of the sound that you love. But yeah, I do think it was probably time for Hawkwind to record better, and they do. And I think that despite the fact that some people are out of the band, it's something that they do take forward.
Yeah, I think they have to. Like, when you think of the albums that are released that you just went through, none of them sound like they were recorded by amateurs in the dark. That sound isn't coveted anymore. So I feel like there are some people you're going to turn off by just sounding like you don't care. Because if they don't care, then why would the listener care? And it's going to be definitely hard to get new fans. By the lack of definition, you just lack appreciation for what is going on, because they are sounding a lot better. Like we said, they are becoming a more professional sounding band, whether they like it or not. And this album, like you said, yeah, really does benefit from the clarity. This track especially, if it was really muddy, it wouldn't actually be anywhere near as enjoyable.
No, exactly. I think there's a lot of stuff recorded, say, you know, 1970 to 72, that has a lot of recorded really quickly. It probably is mic'd up and basically live studio recording. And that's feels to me like it's a fact of the time. But by the time you get to 1976, it's probably not how you should be doing it. And it's good to see that this album, because of what it tries to do, and because of what these different writers in Hawkwind are trying to achieve, they need better standards to do that. And they do hit that. So I'm definitely with them there. So that rounds off side one of the album, and side two kicks off in funky style with the Paul Rudolph track, The Aubergine That Ate Rangoon.
Really good to have an album track that just reminds me of a meme from like 10 years ago. Just do you remember that crab rangoon? There was like it was a picture of a baby cheetah looking at its mother, which just said, "Mother, I require the crab rangoon. The rangoon, mother." I don't know why, that was just a thing.
We're going to have to dig that out.
Oh, yeah, I'll definitely find that out. But just, I think just the word Rangoon is just fun to say. This type of title gives away what Hawkwind are feeling, I think. They've done this before, you know, like things like Spiral, Gateway, sounds epic and spacey and crazy, and Warriors on the Edge of Time and Golden Void sound interesting. And they've had a couple of flippant titles before where they're obviously being dumb. And I think this track absolutely sounds like what they named it. It's a fun little track. It feels a little like filler in that I forget about it after I've listened to it. The one thing that really annoys me in this track is that there's some little looped recording which has this little nee sound in it, and it just sounds so much like the knights that say knee that I can't listen to this track and take it seriously, because it sounds like there are knights going knee all the way through it. So I guess I try to avoid this track just mentally because I spoil it for myself. I guess if I'm trying to look at it objectively, it feels like they're experimenting more with loops, either they're recorded loops or they're rhythmic loops, or they're even just like, I don't know if the loop, which is the little kind of bouncy synth riff, I don't know if that is recorded and looped or whether or not that is played by a person. But it's interesting that this is the year that Oxygen comes out, because the idea of live looping or MIDI controlling synthesizers in order to repeat things, or, you know, like using sequencers to make electronic music, is very much known about and used. So this track feels a little bit like an experimentation with a band playing with sequencers and what they're capable of and loopers. And it feels like a track that was made in a studio, where the other tracks feel like they could have been played live. This track does feel like a kind of studio track, knowing where electronic music's going to go. You know, like, it almost sounds like it could be an early Chemical Brothers track in the way that it's put together. It does feel very artificial, and probably the first real feeling of artificialness that I feel like Hawkwind's ever presented us with.
Yeah, that's interesting.
You just said that's interesting, so I feel like you're about to disagree with me.
Well, I haven't worked out whether I'm going to disagree with you or not. I'll work that out by the time I finish talking. I have had another three shots in the meantime. I really love that little funky opening to this track. I wish that went on, or that it came back, or that I used it somewhere. I'm really digging that. And then it kind of stops. And then the track then kind of plays out. And much like City of Lagoons, it kind of washes over me a bit. Like, the track will come on and then I'll focus on something else. And then suddenly the track's finished and I realized I kind of missed it. And then I'll put it on again and tell myself, now listen to the damn track. Whereas with other tracks, when we're going through this and I'm putting records on, I'm kind of always listening to it, but there's something about some of the instrumentals on this that they create a certain texture or mood, and then they kind of stay there, which makes them quite good background. But I find them quite hard to focus on because I just drift into something else. And this does that. So again, it's not one, you know, I wouldn't go, oh, I don't like this bit and I hate that bit. I love the beginning of it. And then it doesn't quite really take me anywhere.
I think compared to The City of Lagoon, which has a lot more improvisation over it, with this one repeated note that for me, like I said, acts like a reset as a nice way of grounding yourself through the track. This doesn't really have a lot of that. While I think the riff is fun, it's not that kind of riff which for me sustains interest through the 4 or 5 minutes that it exists for. So yeah, I think I get the same thing. I listen to it and go, cool, that's kind of happening. And then you blink and then it's the next track. And I think that doesn't help the idea that I said before, where I feel like the album is very short. I think it is shorter than the previous album. I think I did check. I think even with bonus tracks, this album's only 50 minutes. So when you remove the 10 minutes of bonus tracks, this track is only about 40, 42 minutes, rather than like the solid hour they put in before. So it is literally shorter. But even so, I think because there are these big powerhouse tracks that take up a third of the runtime, to then have these little extra bits thrown in, it makes it feel shorter because, yeah, they're not engaging you in the same way. You know, you just had this really big A side, and then the first track on the B side is not as compelling. It's not working as hard. I think it's fine, but it was never going to elevate itself.
It's funny that you talk about the opening track of side two you'd think would be more compelling. When I stream this, if I'm out or something, it always feels to me that The Aubergine That Ate Rangoon is the end of side one and Curb Crawler kicks off side two. And it always takes me slightly by surprise when I put the vinyl on. That's not how it plays out, because the mood of side one would ease itself out through City of Lagoons and The Aubergine That Ate Rangoon. And then Curb Crawler would be that punchy thing that starts a new set of songs, which brings us to Curb Crawler, I suppose, which is produced by Dave Gilmour of Pink Floyd fame.
Thank you. About to say, you said that in a way that I should have known something.
Dave Gilmour, Pink Floyd. And it's interesting because, of course, Powell wanted City of Lagoons to sound like Pink Floyd. And I have no idea whether Dave Gilmour producing Curb Crawler is linked to Powell wanting to make Pink Floyd type sounds. Curb Crawler was the lead single released from the album. And I don't think that Gilmour had anything to do with the rest of the album. But there's maybe some influence there, perhaps. Because even back in 1976, obviously Dark Side of the Moon had happened. Wish You Were Here had happened. He would have been a man of some significance.
Curb Crawler sounds nothing like a Pink Floyd record, no, to me at least.
Apart from the female backing vocalists, perhaps. But that's, as you say, that's about it.
I did wonder where they came from, because like the piano, I don't feel like female backing vocals do a lot for the Hawkwind sound. I'm just going to come out and say I don't like this track. This track is not fun for me. It feels like it belongs more on the previous album. The bass line is the most Lemmy-ish that we get on this album, I think. It's more strummy, more aggressive. It's more leading. They actually, like, you know, lead with the bass line, which they don't often do. It reminded me of Orgone Accumulator, because they start by just listing stuff that's on the car in the same way they did with Orgone Accumulator. They just told you what it did. There's something about this track which just sounds foreign and unsatisfying on this album. It doesn't sound like a Hawkwind track to me. I'm trying to figure out what it sounds like. For me, I'm not sure why it sounds American, the whole track, which I don't think Hawkwind are. I think Hawkwind lean into their Britishness with their accents, the way they play a lot of things, a lot of their subject matter and stuff. So for this track to suddenly come in and sound like it's trying to do a kind of Eagles sound to me for some reason, it just throws me, and not in an interesting way, because I don't think they're being ironic about this track. I feel like they're being kind of earnest about it, and the earnestness bothers me.
Yeah, no, it's a fair call. It's another kind of Hawkwind boogie, and Silver Machine aside, I'm not really a fan of when Hawkwind do these. It's kind of Kings of Speed again, which I wasn't keen on. It's got some nice little bits to it, but there aren't enough of them, and they're not sustained enough for this to be a track that I really like. It's okay. Ironically, this side of the album needs it, because without this, there is really no energy on this side of the album. So it has a job to do. It's just that I don't really like it. I'm not really interested in Hawkwind writing songs about curb crawling and picking up prostitutes. You can leave that to Thin Lizzy.
You sort of get where I'm coming from, that it sounds like another band has come in and just borrowed their studio for a day.
Yeah, yeah, totally. It's just not the space. I mean, you know, Hawkwind can be whatever they like. They can write whatever they like and whatever they feel, but it's not really what I want from them. And there are plenty of other bands that do this and do it better. So there.
So there, Hawkwind.
So we get to Nick Turner's track, the Nick Turner track on the album, and I believe Simon House as well, Kadu Flyer.
Like Steppenwolf, in not in terms of content, in terms of just like the journey it goes on, this track is a lot more than you think it's going to be, or at least I thought it was going to be. I think this probably has the best use of piano in a Hawkwind track to date, in my opinion. This is the first time I've heard them play with a piano and not felt like it's completely out of place. So maybe there is a future for piano in Hawkwind that I like. We'll see. It's a track which starts out hippie and dreamy, then changes into something more kind of folky, then ends with the whole like desert strum and flutes and pipes and stuff that we've had before. So it goes a lot of different directions in the very short lifespan that it has. I go in and out of liking this track as it proceeds, which is strange because the first three lines of the song I like, and then the delivery changes. And for me, it then goes a bit quaint to really fully enjoy it. Again, I think the delivery becomes more of an annoyance to me, and I don't like it so much. The lyrics feel a little bit harder to get into compared to the lyrics of the other tracks. I mean, even with the Curlcrawler, I know what they're saying and I know what it's achieving. Even if I'm not a massive fan of it, I know it and I get it. The other two tracks I also get. This one starts to get a bit weird about like, I am a Kadu flyer, but I'm climbing a mountain, but the mountain might be in my mind. It might be Everest. Everest is behind me. So which mountain is this? Like, oh my God, geographically, what is going on? I do like the fact that one line has it's got some nice safety advice in it. Never fly through a cloud if there's a mountain in it.
I have that written down as one of my favorite Hawkwind lyrics.
It's always good to get a bit of aviation safety advice into your songs whenever you can. Yeah, I like the jam at the end over the singing personally. The start and the end, I kind of like. The bit in the middle is a bit whatever for me. But again, it's a track which draws your attention in, unlike what the Aubergine That Ate Rangoon did, because it does change so much. It feels more live. Obviously, when you have vocals in it, you have to listen to it more anyway. But I think it has a whole bunch going on and is an interesting track. It feels more Hawkwindy again, just like, you know, bringing us back, something a bit more experimental, taking some of their favorite stuff and just seeing if it squadges together. For me, it's a bit of a failed attempt, but there are some things in here that I do like. It is a track that also finishes compared to a lot of their other ones. They have this strange like reverse gong, which I'm not sure I like as an ending, but it is an ending. So I will give them credit for that, even if I'm not quite sure. It's the ending I would have chose.
It suffers just from being a bit bland, Kadu Flyer. And it kind of makes me a little sad to say that. This is, spoiler alert, this is the last thing that Nick Turner does with Hawkwind. He's gone after this album, which we get to. But I'm looking at Nick Turner, D-Rider and Brainstorm, and this, he's been such a part of classic Hawkwind rise, and he kind of represents so much the countercultural ethos of the band and everything, and it feels like going out on a little bit of a whimper for Nick Turner, which is a shame. I quite like the end of the track, as you say, that jam, but there's not enough in it. And again, we're hang gliding in Kathmandu, which is not what my head wants out of Hawkwind. Although, you know, there's the little playing with being high as a kite or being high on a kite, to coin a phrase. But yeah, it's just a little bland for me. All the other tracks, even the ones that I kind of zone out during, have something a bit more interesting going on. So it's a bit of a shame. There are 7 tracks here, and if I was told I could only keep 6 of them, Kadu Flyer is probably the one I'm getting rid of, which is harsh.
But you were asked hypothetically to do it, so you did it.
I did it. I had no choice in the matter. In the end of the day, I had to act, and I acted decisively.
Like heroes do.
Exactly like heroes do. Which leads us to the final track on the album, which is the Simon House track, Chronoglide Skyway, which is a title that for some reason I hate. I don't know why. I can't tell you why, but for some reason, the title Chronoglide Skyway kind of just rubs me up the wrong way.
Huh. For me, it sounds like a Mario Kart level, like the difficult one in space that they always have. So that's my take on it, which means I don't hate it as much as you do. For me, the track and the music go well together. I feel like I can listen to this, and if someone told me it was called Chronoglide Skyway, I'd be like, yeah, that makes sense to me. I actually really like this track. there's something really nice about it for me. I feel like it scratches the kind of early developmental electronic itch that I had when I was like 16 growing up listening to tracks like Melt by Left Field. It just has a lot of that warmth for me, and it's just strangely very personally evocative. You start with this kind of space wind that sets a kind of tone. It takes its time and then just breaks into this really lovely floaty melody. I'm not sure why, but it reminds me of playing old Spectrum cassette games when I was a kid. It was the very first thing I ever had that played games. My parents got it for me. I think it was a birthday present, and it had like an old light gun, and you know, you put the games in and it would take like 10 minutes to load, and you had the whole kind of like kind of sound while it loaded for like 10 minutes, and then when it did you had to stop the cassette, and that kind of like, you know, taught you patience as a kid, those things. But this kind of music, I'm not sure why, but I think there are some kind of racing games or something that I used to play that had songs, probably nothing like this, but just in my brain that's just where this goes. It just reminds me of this kind of thing. It feels oddly nostalgic to me. It really reminds me, like I said, Left Field, maybe like Orbital, something like that. It just has this very early electronic vibe that I really like. It's one of my favorite closing tracks that Hawkwind have done. It's a nice way of wrapping up the thoughts that they've kind of had in the Aubergine That Ate Rangoon and City of Lagoon. Some of those learnings have come to fruition in this. And when it comes on, like we said before, when I'm conscious of the time that the album takes up in my brain, it kind of goes track one, track two, track seven, with maybe like track three kind of helping out a little bit. But for me, like 1, 2, 7 is the way that this album works in my consciousness. When Hawkwind aren't doing 12-string lamentations or much more heavy, the world is on fire, cybernetic warlords are coming for your children, dystopianness, they occasionally go more in this direction, and I like it when they do it and when they do it well. And for me, this is like the encapsulation of this part of Hawkwind, which I'm starting to enjoy as they get more musically adept and as they start to embrace the synthy side of themselves. You know, when we first got previous albums, the synth was there to kind of give them a little like twinkly element. Now they're massively involved and they're really starting to take play again, at least on this album. And if Hawkwind had to go completely mental to make this one album, to get this track out of it, I'm completely fine with it. Because, yeah, to date, this is one of my favourite tracks.
Fair. Big fan. I'm not as much of a big fan. Interestingly, of course, like your early background has those electronic references in it, and mine don't. So it's slightly more of a push for me to get there on that front. It's much more of a recent thing for me, those kind of electronic side of things. It's probably my favourite of the instrumentals. There's not an awful lot in it. It doesn't quite do enough to lift what is a fairly underwhelming side two. Because Kaidu Fly is fairly bland. Curb Crawler, we said, you know, well, it has the energy, it packs a bit of a punch, but it's not great. And apart from the beginning of the Aubergine That Ate Rangoon, it doesn't do much for me. So Chronoglide Skyway, if it's going to save the second half of the album for me, needs to do something really quite excellent. And for you, it does. And which is brilliant. For me, it never quite gets there. It's okay. It's pleasant. And I kind of feel I'm damning it with Fake Press saying it's pleasant. It sounds like something that if I'd done some music and I played it to someone, they went, yeah, that's pleasant, I'd be gutted. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, like someone telling you that what you did is nice.
It's nice. Yeah, exactly. It's really hideous. You'd rather they went, oh, I hate it, because at least you've made some deep emotional impact on them. But yeah, so I just find it kind of pleasant. It doesn't mean I want to end the album early by just picking the needle up or anything. I'm quite happy to let it play out. But yeah, it doesn't connect with me or get the adrenaline going or get the kind of brain moving into different dimensions like so much Hawkwind does. It just kind of plays itself out. So for me, all of the really stronger points are early. It'd be interesting just playing with the idea of if you reorder the album, if Reefer Madness, which is clearly my favorite song on the album, one of my favorite songs anyway, if it was somewhere else on the album, I wonder if it would have an impact on the tracks around it. Whatever comes after Reefer Madness doesn't have to do as much than the track that comes after Kaidu Flyer. So I don't know, really. Maybe it's the way that the album feels to me, just for my taste, is front-loaded with the powerful stuff. And the second half of the album just kind of meanders its way out. It's interesting. This is the first time We've done it on a one or two tracks basis, but it's the first time that really something has connected with you much more than it's connected with me. So that is the Amazing Music and Astounding Sounds, in no particular order, of Astounding Sounds and Amazing Music. That was as fascinating a track by track as I think we've had yet. Such a tumultuous period in Hawkwind, and something intriguing was going to come out of that, and I think did. So that is the music. Let's talk about that cover.
Or those covers, because I believe that they released the album with either cover and you could kind of take your pick.
Yes, that's right. I believe that the one cover was, in fact, old friend Barney Bubbles, a.k.a. Eddie Brash, a.k.a. Grove Lane, is how he signed himself on this one.
I don't know why he does that, considering that I feel like if you're a graphic artist, referrals are pretty important. And considering no one knows who the hell he is anyway, why you change your name every single time? It seems like he's pathologically against giving himself opportunities to work.
You kind of wonder, don't you? Because either the man just likes to play with people's heads and remain anonymous, or some kind of political situation is going on. Like, you know, when you get films and the director really hates the film and he takes his name off it, and any film you see that's directed by Alan Smithy is a film where the director said, I don't want anything to do with this. Alan Smithy is like the John Doe of filmmaking. But the Barney Bubbles is going, I want to do this. And someone's telling him, no, you must do this. And he's going, Grove Lane. It's hard to say. It's really weird. I need to look more into Barney Bubbles and see what more else there is about him. I believe that had he still been alive, it would have been his birthday, like last week or something. Died horribly young.
I'm kind of glad that you said young. You just left a pause there. Right. He died horribly. I mean, it's not good that he died young, but I would rather he died pleasantly young than just died horribly.
Yeah.
Just a freak permanent marker accident. It was terrible.
Yeah, that was a badly timed pause. So yeah, he did one side. He did the side that I think is now the front cover. And one of Robert Calvert's childhood friends, a guy called Tony Hyde, did the other. But as you say, yeah, they were kind of alternated. I don't know why you'd do that. I've never seen it with the back cover as the front cover.
The back cover's the bird, right?
Yeah, I'm not sure which one is Bubbles and which one is Tony Hyde. I've always assumed that Bubbles did the cover, which is now the front cover. But that's really only because I'm now familiar with the name Barney Bubbles. I know who he is. Therefore, I imagine him to have done the stuff I'm familiar with. But maybe it was Tony Hyde. I mean, the back cover is interesting because it takes us back to a comment that you made about Do-Re-Mi, where you talked about there being the logo for Hawkwind that was kind of reminiscent of 1930s kind of German architecture and the big...
Slightly fascistic emblem. Yeah,
exactly. The big eagle that they used, obviously the hawk for Hawkwind. And that back cover definitely brings that aesthetic right back in.
Yeah, even the very angular Bauhausian look to it has a lot of that vibe to it, which is weird because I don't feel that icon goes with this sound at all. I feel like they should have saved this for when they go a little bit more dystopian and crazy again, because what is now seen as the main album artwork is very different from what they've done before, but somehow fits with the album better. Like, had I seen the back cover as the front cover and then listened to it, I don't think I would have appreciated it as much. Or I would have judged the album by its cover, and I would have been more surprised with what I got. The thrilling stories of science and fantasy, someone who looks like they have a green mohawk, but also orange hair, and I think headphones, and I don't really know much else. It looks like they might be holding a candle. They're covered in some kind of robe. There's like some strange weed sun god in the middle. They might be in the sky. That might be clouds. The Hawkwind logo looks gross. The Astounding isn't centered correctly. And, you know, all this stuff, it's like, it looks much more cut and paste and bizarre, but somehow much more appropriate to the music, where this other one looks like it's going to be like, oh no, come back, Lemmy, we miss you.
Yeah, the back cover, you're expecting to hear Time We Left This World Today. It's definitely that science fiction dystopian thing.
not even that science fiction. This feels more like Psychedelic Warlords or something. You know, it's actually like much more real. So yeah, when you see stuff like this from them, you feel like they're making more of a, sometimes through the medium of sci-fi, but they're making a much more contemporary point.
Yes, no, I agree. Totally agree. And the front cover, all of those graphic elements on that front cover could have been cut out and then positioned. And at least the font, I'm astounding. They were science fiction magazines doing the rounds at the day that the album is effectively named after. One of them was Astounding Science Fiction, Amazing Stories of Science Fiction, those kinds of titles. And the short fiction, science fiction authors of the day would be sending stories in, and they were, you know, Asimov and all this kind of stuff were getting printed in those books. So, and that Astounding is taken pretty much straight off. Yeah, it would be a strange one to see this album now with the back cover as the front cover. I'm sure there are ones out there. I'm not sure that I've come across them before. And what do you make of the inside cover? Just reminds me of The Who Sell Out. I don't know how familiar you are with The Who and The Who Sell Out, but they had the members of The Who doing like fake adverts for household products. It was before this. But here you have Brock's Atomic Piles Cure and something for a He-Man voice. These are all the kinds of adverts that you would find in, well, actually, you wouldn't find adverts for strap-ons in science fiction magazines, but they're obviously parodies of the kind of adverts you would find in science fiction magazines, which would usually be for laser guns and X-ray specs. But yeah, they've put a lot of them on there.
They have. And, you know, this, for me, works still with the vibe of the album. You know, a little bit silly, a little bit playful, some well-meaning use of imaginative ideas. But again, it's that, can you say they like toured the US calling themselves like the Silly Hawkwind Brothers or something? Like, you know, that kind of like weird notion they sometimes get in their brain where they think it's a good idea. I think like there's an element of committing to the theme, which we've seen them do before. It's just that this theme seems to take them into places which obviously is not as popular as maybe they'd hoped. You know, it is very different. It's kind of fun. I like the one that I do like of all of these is the Simon House School of Music saying, play right away any instrument, even if you don't know a single note, which I feel like is a joke to the, you know, the quotes which you said last time about people not only knowing the instruments, but how to play all the notes in the right order and yes, that kind of thing. You know, that feels like a bit of a self-deprecating ad to put in there. There is still some of that Hawkwind imagination, but I feel a little bit like, this might be a weird analogy, but some YouTube personalities who make their money by putting out YouTube videos and then getting, you know, their ad spend, if they don't always have a theme, if they are just like, we are who we are, and some people market themselves as that, then they don't have a theme guiding them, which means that they put out whatever they feel. And sometimes they'll put something out and it'll get millions of views and they'll be amazing. And then they'll put out that one thing, which is either problematic or a bad idea or embarrassing, and it becomes cringe and everyone doesn't like them again. But, you know, they're at such a demand for them to put out stuff that they're just kind of like, this is what I'm going to put out. And it feels a little bit like that with Hawkwind sometimes, that this is just what they felt like doing. And before anyone decided whether or not it was the thing that they should do coming off of something as big as The Warrior on the Edge of Time, they've done it. They've made ads, they've made songs, they've done stuff, and they're like, it's out now. And then they obviously seem to, or at least some of them got mad about the reception of it. I can kind of see it because I feel like they've applied the same amount of energy and imagination to mucking about as they had before by being very earnest about stories about warriors. So I just don't think that they do mucking about as well as they think they do. But again, I know that's me, and I know that's like, you know, as we saw from the Starfighters, they obviously think that some of this is very funny and they keep doing it. I'm less happy to go with them on it just because it's not something that I enjoy. But at least that's how I see from all this. Again, they're committing to the theme. But, you know, sometimes when you commit to a theme so much, if you're not into it, you're just like, this is like Steppenwolf. It's like, this is going on quite a lot. You know, and I'd like it to stop now, please.
My main view really with the cover was the whole thing isn't like a comprehensive package in the way that some of the previous albums have been. Like Warrior, you know, that remarkable cover and everything, and it all, even the inside cover, although it's not done by the same artist, it feels like it fits with the whole thing as a package. The same's true particularly with Space Ritual and that fold out, and In Search of Space with that cover, and it had the logbook in it. The album and the cover and the inside cover all feel like they are intrinsic pieces of the package. Whereas in this case, the front cover and the back cover could easily come from two completely different albums. And the inner sleeve is quite funny. You know, I smiled when I first saw it, and you could see they're having a laugh. It doesn't particularly fit with the front or back covers. So, you know, it's nice work. It's some good artwork. There's some nice ideas. But it's not a package in the same way that I've come to think of Hawkwind albums being a complete package.
They could have made the front cover look much more like a zine than this, whatever it is that they've made, especially considering the inside, with it then being all like the printed ads. It would make much more sense if it had looked like a kind of a comic, and then maybe you'd be more understanding of what they're doing, which is like, you know, they are telling kind of sci-fi stories. The idea of like a reefer monster which eats your brain, and the idea of the wolfman, is even the curb crawler, I guess, it's like a day in the life of a freak. So, you know, there are some songs which work to this theme, but then like the instrumentals are just the instrumentals, which are fine, but it doesn't all gel together in the same way that the other albums have done. So yeah, it all just feels a little bit wayward, a little bit lax, like they put effort into some bits but not into the other bits, and it doesn't feel anywhere near as comprehensive as before. I would love to know what was going through the mind of the designer who put the front cover art together, because for me it's just like, before there were clever ideas of hidden masks, or there were just elegant spaceships all made of circles, and there's much more to artistically appreciate on the back picture, but it's just massively thematically incongruous with the music. If I was told, please pick a cover, I would pick the one that belongs on the front, but I would also ask if there was an option C I could just check, you know, because I don't think any of them are right. If anything, I would say, do you know what, put the inside cover outside, just cover it in adverts and just see what happens.
Yeah, it's funny, there's so completely unrelated, there is an album by Roger Taylor, who is the Queen drummer, and it turns out he's multi-talented. He was going to pick one of his tracks for a podcast fairly recently. His first album is called Fun in Space, and he is a science fiction fan. And a lot of his stuff is like inspired by science fiction stories. And the cover art for his album completely gets the concept over. There's him reading a science fiction magazine featuring a front cover of an alien reading a science fiction front cover magazine with him. And then there are books and paperbacks and things, and they've got titles in them, and they've got all the authors are all anagrams of Roger Taylor. There's things like this going on, and the concept, the thing he had in his head, and the thing he was recording, and the thing he's passionate about, all fits. And given that those two concepts, the albums and the territories are completely different, the kind of concept they've gone in with is similar, and the Taylor album pulls it off much better from an artwork point of view, I think. I'll have to send it to you and we'll post it up, and then people can tell me I'm wrong, and that's fine. So that is the music and that is the cover art, which brings us to what every other Hawkwind fan thinks of it. And as ever, our guide for that is Elric Newby and his book, Hawkwind Fans Worldwide Top 40 Albums. So let's see where Astounding Sounds and Amazing Music places in that top 40. Now, Elric's top 40 includes some live albums and some compilations. So this album places number 13, but Space Ritual is number 3, and Roadhawks, which is the compilation album that you mentioned earlier that has the separate version of Golden Void on it, that places number 11. So actually, this is net 11 of the top 33 or 34 studio albums, whatever they are. This is number 11, which is, you know, not bad. It's the lowest of the recent ones, given that we had, obviously, Warrior on the Edge of Time as number 1. Hall of the Mountain Grill is number 4, if you take out Space Ritual. And In Search of Space at number 8, Do Re Mi at number 7. The first album is low, it's about 15 or something. So 13 for Astounding Sounds, Amazing Music. So again, I think that's tends to, rather than lots of people thinking it's average, I think that's some people really loving the album and some people not really caring. I would imagine that this album has some quite committed fans, basically, and then other people like me who are less taken with it. So there you go. That's what the fandom thinks of it. That's what we think of it in terms of the tracks and the cover art. Matt, some concluding thoughts on Astounding Sounds and Amazing Music at the end of this journey.
This album feels like Hawkwind trying to work out where to go after the clear success of Warrior on the Edge of Time, after Lemmy has gone, I feel like there's some kind of influence or power vacuum which they have tried to fill with new people, bringing in people like Calvert in a more committed way, as well as having band members bring in new things which don't feature all of the band. Which is interesting when you think about it, because I guess they said, hey, we'd like to put this on the album. And at some point someone said, okay, I'm fine with this. Even if they then throw it out the window later, it feels odd that there wasn't at some point someone said no. You know, they're obviously fine with it at some point. So even if the music isn't totally experimental, it's almost like the band is experimental. They're playing with different ingredients again. They're seeing what songs look like when they're not being guided by existing books and themes and that kind of thing. And that comes across nicely with things like Steppenwolf. So there are some well put together pieces on this. There are some bits which feel a bit vestigial, because I feel like they're kind of some noodles that have made it onto the album. But I think if you removed the things which you just think, yeah, it's okay, this album feels a bit more like an EP. I think probably both of us could make 4-track EPs out of this album and not really miss the ones that we decided not to include. So it doesn't feel as complete as some of the other albums. And I think maybe on balance, it suffers for that reason. I guess it's always going to be hard to come back from an album which is a clear fan favorite. And I do like the fact they didn't just try to do what they did again, because they've never done that, which is good. But it does feel like an album which is a little undercooked, maybe. There's some moments of brilliance in it, but it's nowhere near as cohesive as other things, either in the art, which is telling, I think, given how much Hawkwind do put into their audiovisual thing, and also in some of the music, although I like it more than you do. I think I can still admit that there's a couple of tracks on here which don't feel as well put together as some of the others. And I think that the whole thing slightly suffers for that. However, I have found it a very entertaining album in its own right. Maybe time or being like new to it has sweetened it for me. I feel less betrayed or confused or something by it. And it is definitely one where there's stuff that I will listen to again and enjoy. I like the fact that it does actually keep a brisk pace on the whole. That is nice. It was very easy to put on, listen, put on again, and just make notes to. And I do like it when Hawkwind get groovy. So there's some of that which I do really like and would like to see more of in the future, because it does help carry their stuff. But at the same time, I am hoping that some of the more psyche dystopian stuff comes back in again, because I also like it when they do that. And I feel like we haven't had that in a while. So I'm not surprised it is where it is in the fandom. And this, I feel like there's no way they're going to carry on sounding like this. And as you've already set up, a lot of people are going to move on. So this as a kind of interesting, like, service station stop on the road between albums is interesting in its own right as a little thing. But I'm expecting more of the next album. And I'm actually looking forward, based on this, to see what they do next.
Outstanding. So, as you suggested, things happen after this album, and things happen that need to be resolved, I think, on this pod before we get to the next album. So now, Astounding Sounds, Amazing Music, Messy Aftermath. Yes, at the end of this tour, the Hawkwind lineup changes significantly. So we're going to deal with it now, so that we don't have to do it all at the beginning of the next podcast for Quark, Strangeness and Charm. And we can just get into what that lineup is rather than what the previous lineup was. So dealing with Alan Powell and Paul Rudolph first, who are basically kind of ousted at the same time. And an interview here in Days of the Underground by Joe Banks. It's interviews with both Rudolph and Powell. This one from Powell. Joe Banks asks him, "You're quoted in NME as saying your departure was inevitable after the Astounding Sounds tour." And Alan Powell responds, "Yeah, I'd put on James Brown and then Bob Calvert would turn round with a look on his face like, what the F is this? He just hated that kind of stuff. So it was obvious to everybody else. I was saying, look, I'm done with this, guys. So me getting fired was fine. If I was in charge of the band, I would have fired me. So I was perfectly okay with it. I wasn't upset. There were no hard feelings on my part. I still think they were a great bunch of guys. There was no nastiness, which is cool, which again, he comes across as a pretty cool dude for me. He says also in Ian Abraham's book, and really, obviously, this is the last we're going to hear of Alan, and this is what Bob Calvert says. Rudolph and Powell really shouldn't have been considered members of the band. They were session musicians who'd come in to fill a gap that existed. Powell wouldn't disagree. In 76, I went to New York to rehearse with Robert Palmer. I'd written a song that was going to be on his next album. When I got back to do the Astounding Sounds tour, I realized that I'd grown up musically. Hawkwind was just not my scene. Never really had been. I was a hired gun who played with anybody that paid me. That's the way it was in London in the 1970s, when you had a flat in Kensington and a fondness for smoking dope. Years later, the song Life in Detail by Powell and Robert Palmer was included in the film Pretty Woman, the royalties from which enabled Powell to move to San Francisco and buy a yacht. So it all ended well and things kind of moved on. But you can see why I've got a soft spot for Alan Powell. I think he seems like just a regular dude, like having a good time and doing a job. And let's face it, doing it pretty well for the time that he was in the band. So both he and Rudolph are out pretty much at the same time, which leaves us to Nick Turner, which there isn't quite so much of the story behind, which is odd given the presence that he just is in Hawkwind in the early 70s. To kind of sum these things up, this is back to Days of the Underground. Dave Brock believes moves are underway to remove him from the band, with Turner as the rebel leader. Brock quickly launches a counterstrike, persuading the others that it's Turner who needs to go, citing his still variable musicianship. And so at the end of October, the only remaining member of the original lineup is ejected into space, which just smacks of paranoia, he said, she said, kind of dueling for what they think of as control of the band. The truth is that actually, if you look back through the albums, different people had written lots of tracks. There is no person who writes whole albums, really. You could argue that the dominant tracks on the albums have tended to be Brock tracks, but I don't think that's true of everything. But it plays itself out. This whole situation comes to a head. Clearly an unsustainable situation. It comes to a climax, and Turner is out, Rudolph is out, Powell is out. And that really kind of sets up a new lineup of Hawkwind, getting back into the studio to record in 1977. And we've already touched on what an incredible year for music 1977 is. And in the next pod, we will get into Hawkwind's part in that. So that was the pod. It only remains to choose our standout tracks for the two playlists, which is the one track, Matt, which is going to go onto the Hawkbinge Master playlist.
It's going to be Steppenwolf. The track that I wanted to have, I feel, is too controversial even for me. So I'm going to go with this one and bank the other one for the other playlist. But I do feel like this is a nice track. Like I said, the violin through the breakdown is one of my right now favorite sonic moments of listening to Hawkwind. I like the story. I like the delivery. This for me will be a nice milestone of success when Calvert really joins the band and makes his presence felt. So even though it's slightly long, I am looking forward to entering the Magic Theater whenever we go through the playlist again in future.
Outstanding. And I think I can guess, but what is the second track that will make its way onto the Hawkbinge Sessions playlist?
It's going to be Chronoglide Skyway, my definitive Hawkwind instrumental track for the time being, and a track which I will probably put into a couple of other personal playlists of just really good, warm, feel-good music that touches me in ways which I can't quite tell you why they do, but it does.
Cool. That's a pretty eclectic-looking Hawkbinge Sessions playlist, given all of the tracks that we've put on it from the last few albums and all of those turntable picks. And that's actually ready to go now. That's going to be released. So both of the Hawkbinge Sessions playlists, Volume 1 and 2, will be available on Spotify. And the Hawkbinge Master playlist can also be found on Spotify. So if you just search Hawkbinge on Spotify, our podcast and those playlists should be the only things that come up. And if they're not, then there's someone who will be taking to court sooner or later. So those are the playlists, and we hope that you enjoy those. I think those new tracks will fit well into that. So if you want to contact us and tell us your opinions of Astounding Sound and Amazing Music, where you disagree, although it's going to be hard to disagree with both of us on this one, because it feels to me like whatever side you pick, we've taken it somewhere on the pod, but give it your best shot. Tell us where we're wrong. Tell us which of the two album covers was Bubbles, because I'd kind of like to know that now. And I've looked up enough about this album not to go and look it up myself. Where can people do that, Matt?
The easiest ways to get hold of us on social are Instagram and Twitter, which we do check and respond to a lot of. You can find us at Hawk Binge on each one of those. If you'd like to send us something more long form, like an email, we are available to be talked to. Our address is podcast@hawkbinge.space. And this is a time, we don't do this every time, but I would also just like to add a request that if you are still with us in our trail across the astral plane of Hawkwind and their ever-growing discography, we would really appreciate any star reviews or written reviews that you could put into wherever you get your podcast from, because it really does help widen our listenership. And we have so far been really successful, much more. I was going to say that sounds like I thought this wasn't going to go anywhere, which isn't true, but just the stats that we do get from our podcast has always very impressed me. We have actually just passed our 2000th download of the episodes, which makes me feel very proud and happy that people are not only just listening to us once, but, you know, are repeat listeners. And we have a good definite few hundred people who always come across and join us for the ride. So thanks so much for seeing this through with us. And yeah, if you would ever be able to give us a review or a star rating, that really does help us just bring more people in, and hopefully more people can appreciate the band that is Hawkwind, either people who are brand new to it like me or known veterans that always like to hear their band being discussed.
Yeah, absolutely. We really do appreciate it. It's great to know that people out there are listening and engaging. It's nice not to just be, you know, two random guys screaming into the void. It sounds like a Hawkwind track, actually. So thanks for that. And if you are listening to this, then obviously you either love Hawkwind or love hearing about Hawkwind. If you also love hearing about Lynyrd Skynyrd or Black Sabbath or Queen or Iron Maiden, Uriah Heep or Deep Purple, or you just like interviews of musicians and music stories from the past, and different people talking about their life in music, then you should check out the Deep Dive Podcast Network, which we are proud to be members of. And you can do that by searching #DeepDivePodNet. And you can just do that in any search engine, and it will bring up all of the different podcasts that are in there, and you should check them out. I'm a regular listener. There are some great ones in there. And if you really don't like my pick for Iron Maiden and my verdict on the new track, then Maiden AZ is part of the Deep Dive Podcast Network, and you should check them out. That's us done for this album. We will be back as soon as we can, when you will experience some charm from Matt, some strangeness from me, and some quark from the two of us. And we will see you then.